from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, I figured out why it's a bad idea to do a radio program on a Sunday. Because nobody else is in the facility, no matter what the facility is. And the air conditioning just goes haywire. You know, I came to New Orleans to warm up. Anyway, I'm not picking on any particular administration. Why would I? But certainly it seems as though the recent trend in this country is for administrations of either party to try to discourage the act of remembering, whether it's a nasty-sounding command from the press secretary in a previous administration, you better watch what you say, or whether it's a sort of an amiable, smiling, friendly, avuncular, we're not looking backward, we're looking forward. There seems to be, if I may, and I think I may, a war on memory going on. But memory is a useful thing sometimes. This very weekend on the BBC, you've heard of it, they talk like this. They broadcast a program, a documentary, if you will, going back to review, of all things, the 1968 election campaign for a reason. Recently, about 5 years ago, the LBJ Library, I know it sounds funny, and it is, by the way, they have, at least they did when I first visited it, the only time I visited it, had a 7/8 size replica of the Oval Office. 7/8 size. You got to call up somebody and say, yeah, we need a 7/8 size phone. Anyway, the LBJ Library released some tapes that President Johnson had made. And over the last few years, they've been declassifying them because they apparently had material on them. And the thrust of this documentary was that, thanks to those tapes, we now know that Lyndon Johnson had come very close to getting the South Vietnamese and the North Vietnamese together with the United States in the fall of 1968 to talk together on condition of a halt in the U.S. bombing of the North about a ceasefire in the Vietnam War. And he had called both Hubert Humphrey and Richard Nixon, and for that matter, George Wallace, the three candidates for president, to tell him that and say, you know, don't mess around with this. This is sort of important for the country. And lectured them. And I heard the tape. Now, you know, it's interesting to me because I did know that LBJ taped, but I had kind of lost the attention, lost the focus on LBJ's tapes after I got this one a few years ago.
Joe, is your father the one that makes clothes?
Yes, sir. We're all together.
You all made me some real lightweight slacks that he just made up on his own, sent to me 3 or 4 months ago. It's a kind of a light brown and a light green, rather soft green and soft brown.
Yep.
And they're real lightweight. Now, I need about 6 pairs for summer wear.
Yes, sir.
I want a couple, maybe 3 of the light brown, kind of a almost powder color, like powder on a lady's face.
Yes,
then there was some green. Now, another thing, the crotch down where your nuts hang is always a little too tight. So when you make them up, give me an inch that I can let out there because they cut me. They're just like riding a wire fence. These are almost, these are the best that I've had anywhere in the United States. But when I gain a little weight, they cut me under there. So, leave me, you never do have much margin there. But see if you can't leave me about an inch from where the zipper ends, round under my, back to my bunghole.
All right, then.
Yeah, so I'd lost attention to the LBJ tapes after that. Anyway, he called Nixon and Humphrey and George Wallace and said, don't mess with this. And then learned that Nixon had dispatched a contact, a woman high up in Republican circles by the name of Claire Chennault, to discuss this with the South Vietnamese president and to say, to relay Nixon's request that the South Vietnamese president withdraw from those peace talks because Nixon was going to get him a better deal after the election. Johnson found out about this. There's a tape of Johnson describing it as treason, treasonous. And then he decides not to make it public because if he had, it would have become known that he was wiretapping Nixon, which Nixon knew anyway, as is evident from one of the Nixon tapes, which you may actually see dramatized in Nixon's The One on British television this coming summer. But enough about me. Nixon knew that Johnson was taping him. So the point is, memory kind of is an interesting thing sometimes. There is a theory, probably pretty credible at this point, that what Nixon was looking for in the Watergate burglary and in his quashed plan to firebomb the Brookings Institution was the tapes that LBJ had, the material that LBJ had. But Johnson had, before leaving the White House, spirited that stuff away, given it to an advisor of his who would put it in something called, and this sounds Hollywood, doesn't it? Envelope X, which was supposed to be kept secret for another 50 years. But somebody opened it up, so we know all this now. Ladies and gentlemen, memory is power. Hello, welcome to the hell is the name of this? Oh, hello, welcome to the show.
É o fim do caminho, é o resto de toco, é um pouco sozinho, é um caco de vidro, é a vida, é o sol, é a noite, é a morte, é o laço, é o anzol, é peroba do campo,
é o nó da madeira,
canga, candê,
é uma tita pereira,
é madeira de vento,
da rimanceira,
é um mistério profundo,
é o queira ou não queira,
é o vento ventando.
Chuva chovendo, é conversa ribeira das águas de março, é o fim da canseira.
É o pé, é o chão,
é a mastradeira,
passarinho na mão,
pedra de atiradeira.
É uma ave no céu,
é uma ave no chão,
é um regato, é uma fonte,
é um pedaço de pão,
é o fundo do poço, é o fim do caminho, no rosto desgosto, é um pouco sozinho, é um estrepe,
é um pé. É o tijolo chegando.
É a lenha, é o dia. É o fim da picada. É a garrafa de cana. Estilhaço na estrada.
É o projeto da casa. É o corpo na cama. É o carro enguiçado. É a lama, é a lama.
É um passo.
É uma ponte.
É um sapo.
É uma rã.
É o resto
de mato.
Na luz
da manhã.
São as águas de março. Fechando o verão. Minha promessa de vida no teu coração. É José,
é um espinho,
na mão,
é um corte,
no pé,
são as águas de março, fechando o verão, é a promessa de vida no teu coração. É pau,
é pedra,
é o fim
do caminho,
é um resto
de toco,
é um pouco,
sozinho, é um passo, é uma ponte,
é um sapo, é uma rã,
é um belo horizonte,
é uma febre terçã.
vida no teu coração.
Badaba, badibadiza, zazaziza, azananienha, anandede.
From the edge of Lake Pontchartrain, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. Burdened by memory, as we will be. Ladies and gentlemen, all you need to know about the stock market in 20 seconds. It has been estimated, says financial writer Wallace Turbeville, that today 73% of stock trading volume, 73% of what's traded on the stock market, is a result of algorithmic high-frequency trading. It has changed fundamental characteristics of markets. It's estimated at the end of the Second World War, the average holding period for a stock was 4 years. By the turn of the millennium, 8 months. By 2008, the average holding period declined to 2 months, and it's estimated that at least for actively traded shares, by 2011... the average period in which a stock is held before being sold is down to 22 seconds, ladies and gentlemen. That tells you everything you need to know. What the frack? Many of Pennsylvania's policymakers, regulators, and enforcement workers who regulate or otherwise have some say over the fracking industry, the hydraulic fracking of natural gas, for your and my enjoyment. Where do they come from? They come from the oil and gas industry, the overseas, or they leave state jobs for industry jobs in that very industry, according to a recent report that questions the impact of such a revolving door on public policy decisions. This is from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. A report titled Fracking and the Revolving Door in Pennsylvania identified 45 current or former state officials who have links to the energy industry and gas drilling and fracking regulation, including 28 who have left to take industry jobs. The 30-page report released by the Public Accountability Initiative, a Buffalo, New York-based nonprofit. Ooh, to be a nonprofit in Buffalo. Ooh, that sounds colder than where I am. The report said that attrition from government jobs to positions in the regulated industry calls into question the commitment of those employees to enforce regulations on the companies they could soon work for. Enforcement could also be hurt, the report said, when industry executives move into regulatory positions in government. The last four governors, including Tom Corbett, have strong ties to the natural gas industry, as do a number of administrators from previous governors' offices and 20 Department of Environment administrators and employees, Democrats and Republicans alike. That's nice. There's bipartisanship for you, including all five Environment Department secretaries since the department was created in 19, all the way back in 1995. What the frack? Whistleblowers, news of the godly, ladies and gentlemen, now, for your listening pleasure, whistleblowers who spoke out about child abuse in the Anglican Church received death threats and were effectively excommunicated. This is been told to a parliamentary inquiry. Former Anglican priest Paul Wallacker told the inquiry church members who reported cases of child abuse were publicly shamed and given no support from the church. This is the Anglican Church, ladies and gentlemen. They split from the Catholics hundreds of years ago. But still, Father Wallacker said he was refused communion in the 1990s after blowing the whistle. Well, on a parish priest who was involved with a student in regional Victoria. This is in Australia. The support we received from the diocese was zip, zero, zilch, Father Wallacker said, showing his familiarity with words beginning with Z. He said the children were harassed at church. His children were harassed at church, in their workplace, and while walking to school by supporters of the offending priest, and he was forced to live in secrecy. I had to sell my house quickly. I had to move. I had to pay for counseling for my daughter. Can you imagine what it's like having people you've known virtually all your life turn around spitting at you and calling you a liar because they don't want to believe the truth? He said he was heartbroken when he was refused Holy Communion by his church and was forced to take it in secrecy. He left the Anglican Church and is now an Orthodox Christian priest. He called on religious organizations to be forced to tell victims of any admissions of abuse, even if there's no criminal investigation. Well, why wouldn't there be a criminal... Oh, I see. News of the Godly, ladies and gentlemen, copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
NASCAR driver Jeremy Clements apologized for using a racial slur and begged for a second chance after returning from a two-week suspension for his comment to a reporter at Daytona International Speedway. The 28-year-old driver from Spartanburg, South Carolina, was helping an MTV blogger find the hauler of another driver late last month when, according to MTV, he used the N-word to illustrate that drivers who race too aggressively will be roughed up. "I wasn't thinking," Clements told reporters at Bristol Motor Speedway. "I was just walking along trying to help the guy find somebody else. I just blurted it out. As soon as I did, I knew I didn't do good. I knew I messed up, but it was too late, and I just kept talking. It was stupid." Driving for his family-owned team, Clements opened the media session with a lengthy apology, saying, "I made a remark that has no place in our society." He said he didn't mean to offend anyone. He said that using the racial slur is not indicative of who he is. He said his grandfather was a crew chief for an African-American racer in 1965. "It doesn't represent who I am or what I'm about. Hopefully I can make it right and show who I really am," he said. The director of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's Media Lab has apologized after a furor erupted over wristbands adorned with pickup lines that were distributed at one of the lab's parties during South by Southwest in Austin. The pickup lines include, quote, "That's a nice dress. It would look great on my floor." And, "Do you wash your clothes with Windex? Because I can see myself in your pants." The controversy spreads quickly after a picture of the wristband circulated online. Joy Ito, the lab's director, apologized, calling the handouts offensive and saying that they in no way reflect the sentiments of the MIT Media Lab. He added they'd been provided by the party venue and said the lab didn't realize what was printed on them until after they'd been distributed. The lab is fully committed to supporting women in the sciences, he said. The Archdiocese of Los Angeles has issued a statement in which it apologized to priest abuse victims ahead of a news conference at which one victim said his faith has been shattered. The Archdiocese reached a $9.9 million settlement with four victims of former priest Michael Baker. $9.9 million. Please give. The statement issued this week said Baker deceived parishioners, therapists, church leaders, and most of all, his victims. The Archdiocese has expressed deep regret for the mistakes made in handling his case and has taken responsibility for the terrible harm he inflicted upon his many victims. "We continue to pray earnestly for all victims," it said. Fox, Connecticut, apologized this week for airing what it called inappropriate file footage of women during a news report on Women's Day at the state capitol. "The video should never have aired," the company said in a statement. Fox, Connecticut will publicly apologize on today's newscast as well as through our social media platforms. "We're also implementing procedures to keep this from happening in the future. The footage of fully clothed women focused on their breasts and drew immediate criticism on Facebook and Twitter." Fox, Connecticut is not owned by Fox. Despite the name, it's owned by Tribune Company. Vice President Joe Biden's press secretary apologized to a Capitol News Service reporter and the Philip Merrill College of Journalism this week after a press office staffer demanded that the reporter delete photos taken at a press event in Rockville, Maryland. The reporter, a credentialed member of the press who's a student at the College of Journalism, was covering a domestic violence event featuring Biden, Eric Holder, and a Maryland senator. The apology came shortly after a formal complaint was filed with the vice president's press office by Lucy Dalglish, dean of the College of Journalism at the University of Maryland. "This was pure intimidation," Dalglish said, adding, "It's clear from the circumstances the journalist did nothing wrong." Biden press secretary Kendra Barkoff would not speak on the record with Capitol News Service, but Dalglish said Barkoff apologized to her and the reporter, Jeremy Barr, in separate phone conversations. Dogley said Barkoff told her the incident was a total miscommunication. Really, by the press office. Ironic. And it was the press office. It is never the press office's policy to request the reporters delete photos. Barr said he unknowingly sat in a section of the crowd designated as a non-press area. I didn't see any demarcation that would have designated a press entrance, he said. This event began, and I took a few photos of each speaker. People a few rows in front of me were also taking photos. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And now, news of AFAC! News of our friends in the Afghanistan-Pakistan nexus, don't you know? First of all, the American commander, well, I should start with the other story. There are two stories. I'm going to start with this one. Afghan President Hamid Karzai lashed out at the United States in strikingly acerbic terms this week, implying that the American military was stoking violence in collusion with the Taliban to justify a prolonged presence in Afghanistan and charging that foreign troops were harassing Afghan university students. The remarks painted an embarrassing picture of discord that marred Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel's first foreign trip as Pentagon chief and plunged the tenuous allies into crisis mode at a time when the United States is struggling to wind down the unpopular war. Afghan and American officials provided differing accounts about why a joint news conference that had been expected to be the center place of Hagel's trip was canceled. Later, Hagel met with Karzai in private, and the secretary then told reporters he was hopeful the two countries could overcome the latest crisis. And the American commander in Afghanistan responded by quietly telling his forces to intensify security measures, issuing a strongly worded warning that a string of anti-American statements by Karzai had put Western troops at greater risk of attack, both from rogue Afghan security forces and from militants. The order came after Karzai suggested his government might unilaterally act to ensure control of the Bagram prison if the United States delayed its handover. They're arguing about whether certain prisoners at Bagram, notorious prison in the Air Force base near Kabul, would continue to be held once the Afghans take over the prison. An array of Afghan political leaders issued a joint statement criticizing Karzai and saying his statements and comments did not reflect their views. The threat advisory from the commander, General Joseph Dunford, specifically mentioned Karzai's comments about Bagram prison, calling it an inflammatory speech. His comments came after weeks of increased tension over his public comments about the United States, including banning special ops forces from a critical province. His harsh stance has been interpreted as an attempt to improve his domestic political image by appealing to Afghan sovereignty. All these remarks may destroy our relations with the international community, and especially America, and lead to the isolation of Afghanistan again, said Faizullah Zaki, the spokesperson for General Abdul Rashid Dostum, the powerful Uzbek leader and warlord who campaigned for Karzai in his 2009 election and later fell out with him. Well, that's how it looks from here. How does it look from there?
From Afghanistan Public Radio, where the more you listen, the less you know. From the newly encircled presidential palace in downtown Kabul, where it's always President's Day sale, I'm Mahmoud.
And I'm the universally loved Hamid. We're Crank and Kronk, the Flip It Brothers. Welcome to another edition of Karzai Talk.
When you say flippant, you're referring to a certain bird.
Giving a certain bird to a certain eagle, yes. Today's show is brought to you with the help of Dubai Realtors, serving the Afghan leadership class since they started calling.
Well, you definitely won the Mr. Congeniality Award this week, my younger brother.
The thing you don't understand, my older brother, is that democracy is not a popularity contest.
But the thing you don't understand is the dosage instructions on the label on your meds.
Old Karzai family saying, even a beggar can be proud.
Old Karzai family saying, it's easy to make up new old Karzai family sayings.
But, to tell you the truth, Mahmoud,
yes,
didn't you sell more Toyotas this week than last week?
Oh, of course, Hamid.
Well?
Because more people are making plans to get the heck out.
Hey, maybe the country will lose enough people to have one whole less tribe.
Mm-hmm. Bringing it down to an even 50.
Hello, you're on Karzai Talk.
Hello, this is General Dunford, longtime commander, first-time caller.
General, welcome. I hope you don't think we're being inflammatory today.
No. So far, just some amateurs, public radio fun.
Huh? That's our slogan. So, General, have I caused any green and blue attacks today?
No, sir. And I just wanted to say that that so-called threat assessment that you may have read about was never meant to have been made public, and it was leaked with that very caveat attached to it.
Well, you know, sir, one of your predecessors, General Petraeus, was famed for being known as a soldier scholar.
Yes, sir.
You may be earning a distinguished reputation as a soldier leaker.
As long as it's in that order, sir. But seriously, I do have a question.
Oh, thank goodness we were about to go off format.
That could really set off some violence.
I doubt that.
Ah, you don't know radio management.
Go ahead, sir. We could do this all day.
Well, on this matter of insider attacks or the so-called green on blue incidents, which language we are now avoiding, because for Americans, both green and blue sound like the good guys.
Oh, I know the feeling.
What is it that we, or you, for that matter, can do to tamp down these incidents, at least during these next 18 months or so, when political leadership in the States will still possibly be paying attention?
Well, sir, that is a good question.
That means he's stalling.
Come on. Obviously, having a greater sensitivity to local cultural mores 8 or 9 years ago would be a good place to start.
That.
No, but you couldn't go wrong by solving the transportation problems of a lot of our soldiers.
More tanks?
I think more Toyotas.
Thanks for the call.
You hung up on the general?
He was calling collect.
We could have another pledge drive.
Yes, we could.
Hello, you are on Karzai Talk.
Hello, it's General Dostum, long-time warlord, first-time caller.
Abdul, you don't mind if I call you by your first name? We've known each other since you killed my first campaign manager.
Well, you know what they say, politics makes strange corpses.
Not an old Karzai family saying.
No. What can I do for you, Abdul?
Well, you could cut short the timeline on the inevitable.
And that is?
Move to that new house in Dubai this year.
Oh, no. He had some paperwork issues.
Oh, you need to transfer ownership to a Bahamian trust?
No. He's being literal. For insulation, they just stuffed paper in the walls.
I know those people. But Abdul, this is a good time for you, isn't it?
I am doing okay. It is a good time to be Uzbek.
The last time somebody said that was when Marco Polo stopped by.
So, whatever my little brother might say, this is a period for you to take advantage of your good fortune.
Mahmoud, please. I already bought a new Toyota. But I just wanted to ask, If the Americans go away in a huff, who is going to be paying my commissions?
Abdul, nobody wants us to not be Pakistan's friend more than India. Do I have to draw you a picture of a million rupee bill?
You know what I think, Abdul?
What's that?
I think my younger brother is only pretending not to take his meds.
Thanks for the call. You are giving away all my secrets.
The good ones I sell, no?
Fair enough. We had help today from the Warlord Foundation. Warlords, for when you care enough not to be nice.
Legal services for cars I talk from the law firm of Ketchum & Newcomb. I'm Mahmoud. Don't govern like my brother.
I'm Hamid. Don't do business like my brother. But join us again next time for another edition of Cars I Talk. This is APR, Afghanistan Public Radio.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. British soldiers fighting in Afghanistan are part of a campaign that attempted to impose, quote, an ideology foreign to the Afghan people and was, quote, unwinnable in military terms, according to a report by the British Ministry of Defense. This is published this week in the Independent newspaper. The internal study for the Ministry of Defense says that NATO forces have been unable to, quote, establish control over the insurgents' safe havens, or, quote, protect the rural population, and warns the conditions do not exist to guarantee the survival of the Afghan government after combat troops leave next year. The report, obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, well, we'll have to do something about that, says that when troops leave, Afghanistan, quote, will be left with a severely damaged and very weak economic base, unquote, which means the West will have to continue to fund, quote, large-scale support programs for many years to come. Even if the internal situation were stable, the Afghan government may not survive the destabilizing activities of its neighbors. Quote, regional players do not have a vested interest in the success of the Kabul government, states the document in a clear reference to Pakistan. The report, Lessons from the Soviet Transition in Afghanistan, is an internal research project produced by the Ministry of Defense's think tank. The study examines, quote, the extraordinary number of similar factors that surround both the Soviet and NATO campaigns in Afghanistan and highlights lessons that military commanders could learn. That's going to happen. Could have learned them from the Soviets. The highest level parallel is both campaigns were conceived with the aim of imposing an ideology foreign to the Afghan people, it says. Equally striking is that both abandoned their central aim once they realized the war was unwinnable in military terms, and that support of the population was essential. In unusually frank terms, it goes on, the international setting for both campaigns has significant similarities, with world opinion judging both as failed interventions. And one more item of news from outside the bubble. Slightly less depressing. If you found that depressing. The apostrophe is being banned from street names in parts of Devon in England to, quote, avoid potential confusion, the BBC reports. Mid-Devon District Council said its new streets had not contained apostrophes for many years. The policy was now being made official. It said apostrophes could only be found in three street names in the district. Beck Square and Blundell's Avenue and St. George's Well were all named many, many years ago. Said a proofreader, Mary DeVera Taylor, the thought of apostrophes being removed made her shudder. It's almost as though somebody with a giant eraser is literally trying to erase punctuation from our consciousness. To me, there's something terribly British and terribly reassuring about well-written and well-punctuated writing, she said, adding, some may say I should get a life and get out more. But if I got out more and saw place names with no apostrophes where there should be, I shuddered to think how I'd react. A statement from the council said, our proposed policy on street naming and numbering covers a whole host of practical issues, many of which are aimed at reducing potential confusion. It declined to comment further. It did not elaborate on who might be confused by the use of correct pronunciation. That's Arch. Arch writing from the BBC. You know him. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. So, memory. It is coming up to the 10th anniversary of shock and awe of the United States invasion of Iraq. It's memorable for me personally because I had to clear like 2.5 minutes at the beginning of this show so that my local station in Los Angeles could broadcast news because they thought, hey, we got to report news about the Iraq thing. I found that shocking, but not awe-inspiring. But of course, there will be, and there already has been, some looking back, despite the admonition of our president. The Dick Cheney documentary aired a couple days ago on Showtime. He's full of no regret, among other things. But I shared with you a few weeks ago an interview with Greg Thielen, who was a non-proliferation, anti-proliferation analyst in the U.S. State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, the intelligence agency operating inside the State Department, the one that warned Colin Powell, this stuff is bogus. Thielen went public before the war. Two other intelligence analysts, fairly high ranking, did too. One in Britain, Dr. Brian Jones, one in Australia, Andrew Wilkie. Dr. Brian Jones died a year ago. Wilkie is now in the Australian Parliament and doesn't do, apparently, interviews on this subject anymore. But you will hear, moments from now here on this broadcast, their words from some time ago as a way of placing into context the claim that the problem in Iraq was an intelligence failure. But first, just to connect the dots, here's where we started.
A farewell to Frank Clinton that Bush chose to ignore. A lessening of emphasis when the experts called for more. Some strange young guys in flight school who couldn't learn to land. And tragedy at 400 knots. Next time, we'll connect the dots. Life gives you clues that you can use, sometimes makes the news seem so clear in the land of afterthoughts. He was the chairman of a firm known far and wide for doing well, rebuilding what the army just destroyed. Got his deals the easy way, no bidding to withstand. Them that has might just be them. Take what comes, some just might be a
admire. If it's just made out of sand, things are going great. Ignore the shots. Go buy some stuff. Don't worry about the dots. Life gives you clues that you can use. Sometimes makes them use. Some of us in lifeboats, some in yachts. One day soon.
Written evidence from Andrew Wilkie to the British Parliamentary Select Committee on Foreign Affairs. For most of the last 4.5 years, I've been employed as a senior intelligence analyst at the Australian Office of National Assessments. ONA is the senior Australian intelligence agency responsible for providing assessments to the Prime Minister and senior ministers on any offshore issue of importance to Australia. I resigned on March 11th this year, 2003, out of concern for the Australian government's support for an invasion of Iraq. There's been some suggestion by the Australian government since I resigned that I was not involved in the Iraq issue. This assertion is inaccurate. Only half an hour before I resigned, I was involved in an Iraq National Intelligence Watch Office planning meeting. I've also worked specifically on weapons of mass destruction. For instance, in 1998, I prepared the formal ONA assessment on WMD and terrorism. My public observations about Iraq's links with Al-Qaeda are also, I believe, reasonably well informed. During 1999, I was the only ONA analyst covering global terrorism. More recently, I've been involved in the issue to a lesser degree, but including responsibility during 2002 for briefing on two occasions the peak Australian coordinating body for politically motivated violence. Finally, in my former core role as the senior ONA transnational issues analyst, I was involved routinely in matters relating to Iraq. This provided me with virtually unrestricted access to the intelligence database on that country, a privilege not accorded to many other people in ONA, given the careful compartmentalization of intelligence in force there. I resigned because of my strong belief that an invasion of Iraq at that time would be wrong. It had everything to do with my assessment that invading Iraq would not be the most sensible and ethical way to solve the Iraq issue. And it's useful to understand that I put on the public record at the time I resigned my assessment that Iraq's conventional armed forces were weak and no threat to anyone, that Iraq's WMD program was disjointed and contained, and that there was no hard evidence of any active cooperation between Iraq and Al-Qaeda. I believe that any lingering questions about my understanding of the Iraq issue should be silenced by the accuracy of my pre-war assessments. What I am saying, quite simply, is that the British, American, and Australian governments grossly exaggerated the threat posed by Iraq's WMD program in order to justify the war. London and Canberra, in particular, were driven by their strong desire to stay in step with Washington at any cost. In the UK, the exaggeration of the Iraq WMD threat was achieved through a string of public statements, nowhere more apparent than in the September 2002 dossier entitled Iraq's Weapons of Mass Destruction, the assessment of the British government. I found this document to be fundamentally flawed because of the way in which it filled the significant intelligence gaps that existed on Iraq with piles of arguable information based on worst-case assumptions finely tuned to the UK government's predetermined commitment to support a U.S. invasion of Iraq. The dossier implies that Iraq could still have had up to 360 tons of bulk chemical agent up to 3,000 tons of precursor chemicals, enough growth media to produce tens of thousands of liters of biological agent, and over 30,000 special munitions capable of delivery of chemical and biological agents. This list appears to me to be simply ridiculous, not least because no one, not even the Iraqis themselves, seem to know exactly how much chemical and biological agent was ever produced by Iraq, exactly how much was used during the 1980-88 Iran-Iraq War, or exactly how much was destroyed outside of UN control. The list of unaccounted-for material also seems to me to be absurd because it fails to properly consider the critical issues of agent purity and degradation over time. The simple fact of the matter is that most chemical and biological agents soon break down unless produced to a very high level of purity and then effectively stabilized. But Iraq has always had great difficulties achieving high levels of agent purity, and British claims about Iraq having the knowledge and capability to add stabilizer is, in my opinion, unsubstantiated by hard intelligence. The issue of accuracy is especially relevant to the by now well-known and discredited claim that Iraq was seeking to procure uranium from Niger. My understanding of this matter is that the CIA knew as far back as early 2002 that the uranium purchase story was false. Not that this stopped the African uranium story from helping to underpin the case for war in London, Washington, and Canberra. Just like how the story about the thousands of aluminum tubes was given a central role, despite the fact that the International Atomic Energy Agency had serious concerns about the whole story since December 2001. Or the fact that the gas centrifuge that might just have been made with the tubes would have sucked up enormous quantities of uranium and electricity and required a vast and obvious industrial complex. These matters are not recounted with the benefit of hindsight. Rather, these are the sorts of issues which contributed to my decision before the war to resign. And I was not alone. The sorts of doubts I had were shared by others, so much so that the strong, unambiguous language contained in the September dossier and other statements seems to have been more the work of salespeople than professional intelligence officers. Of course, one of the reasons for such inaccuracies was the flood of disinformation that came out of Iraq in recent years from opponents of the regime desperate for U.S. intervention. Such poor human intelligence would once have been discarded by competent intelligence agencies, but the apparent direct political interference with intelligence agencies in the U.S. and more subtle political pressure apparently applied in London and Canberra meant that the rules were different with Iraq. Intelligence that once would have been discarded was now usable with qualification. The problem was that the juicy bits of intelligence most in accord with the government's positions were being latched onto, and the qualifications were being dropped. Dr. Brian Jones was with the British Defense Intelligence Service, and as that British document, the so-called dodgy dossier, was being prepared, he led a group of analysts in objecting to many of the conclusions, a scenario that he deals with at length in his book, Failing Intelligence. But here are some summary statements by Dr. Brian Jones, who again went public with his statement that the intelligence was being mischaracterized before the war. You probably heard about him on, oh, that's right, you listen to public radio. Dr. Brian Jones of Britain's Defense Intelligence Service, from his book, Failing Intelligence. Washington has decided that proliferation had to be tackled by means beyond diplomacy. Where diplomacy has failed, it was decided that the development of such capabilities should be prevented by military action. Saddam's Iraq presented itself as the first doable example of a perceived belligerent WMD proliferator. Propaganda based on intelligence was now required to confirm the existence of WMD. The diplomatic approach had required information at one level of certainty to make a case for concerted action with foreign governments on sanctions. But now more detailed and persuasive intelligence of an actual threat was needed to justify military action by persuading public opinion that a war was worth paying for with lives and money. The quality of information demanded was not available in the intelligence that existed on Iraq or could be reasonably guaranteed to be available in any other situation. Unfortunately, intelligence leaders were too concerned about the preservation of their domain to acknowledge this. There was a more sustainable case that could have been made about the problem of Iraq and WMD, but it involved potential threats and future weapons rather than actual threats and existing stockpiles. And there was neither the inclination in Washington nor the time in London for politicians to explain this more subtle alternative. The bald accusation that Iraq possessed major quantities of such weapons and was a threat proved to be without foundation. The consequence was to set back the cause of non-proliferation. The limitations of intelligence have been painfully and dangerously exposed. There was a need, if not to fix intelligence around the policy, then to mold it close enough to do a good supporting job. A quiescent intelligence community would have allowed this to happen without a murmur. But the organization was sound at its roots, requiring the leadership to take exceptional measures to override its experts. Dr. Brian Jones. And so, here we are, 10 years later. We've paid about $1 trillion for the war. And what do we have to show for it? Well, here's a musical inventory.
Yeah!
ladies and gentlemen, that's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations, over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America, via the shortwave giant, WBCQ, the planet, on the Mighty 104 in Berlin, around the world via the internet, at two different locations, live and archived, whenever you want it, at harryshearer.com. Available for your smartphone through Stitcher.com. Available via Sideshow Networks, and available as a free podcast through KCRW.com and through iTunes. And it'd be just like remembering the end of this sentence if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Already, thank you very much. A tip of the show, chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, in exile, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead, and thanks to Jenny Lawson, the legendary Jenny Lawson here at WWNO, for help with today's broadcast. The host of this broadcast natters on Twitter on occasion, pretty regularly, as a matter of fact. Join us. Join the 83,000 of us at the Harry Shearer. It's warm in there. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from New Orleans.